Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 78, The Legacy of Dr. Timothy Leary, February 22, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I miss him more than anybody, because Tim at his best could make you feel like the entire world was a fabulous party, and that he was the gracious host. And the kind of the energy that you could get from hanging out with him for a day or a week could last you for months. I mean, it was almost mystical. You know, it was almost like one of those gurus who puts his finger on your third eye and suddenly you're illuminated, except he hated all that bull. And it was just his joie de vivre, you know. But it was so powerful. And, you know, he could be a real cretin sometimes, too.
That was the voice of my guest, Are You Serious?, reminiscing about his friend, collaborator, and mentor, the inimitable and infamous Dr. Timothy Leary. Are You Serious?, who was born as Ken Goffman, is an American writer, musician, and cyber culture icon, best known as co-founder and original editor-in-chief of the first popular techno-culture magazine, Mondo 2000, in the early 1990s. His most recent book is True Mutations, Interviews on the Edge of Science, Technology, and Consciousness. His other books have included Mondo 2000, A User's Guide to the New Edge, Design for Dying, The Revolution, Quotations from Party Chairman Are You Serious?, and Counterculture Through the Ages, From Abraham to Acid House. In the 1990s, he wrote columns for Wired News, Art Forum International, and the San Francisco Examiner, and was a regular contributor to Wired Magazine, and his writing appeared in Time, Rolling Stone, Esquire, Vanity Fair, the San Francisco Chronicle, Salon, Village Voice, and many other mainstream and alternative publications. He's currently the host of the Neophiles and the Are You Serious Show podcasts on the Mondo Globo Network at www.mondoglobo.net, and he's a regular contributor to the online magazine 10 Zen Monkeys, which you can find at 10zenmonkeys.com. Now, here's the interview. Are You Serious? Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a thrill for me because I followed your byline over the years and in a number of publications. I think I was a reader of the magazine that you published some years back, Mondo, what was it, Mondo 2000?
Mondo 2000, yeah, popular in the early 90s, actually.
Right, and then I've seen your byline in Wired magazine. I'm a habitual reader of Wired.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm a big fan of your two podcasts. Like me, you've got two podcasts, and I have to say they're right at the top of my podcast listening. So that's why I'm so excited to have you on here.
And well, thank you.
And you're one of very few guests I've had that's not a psychologist, that's not sort of in the world of psychology or mental health per se.
I've been to a psychologist.
Okay. I think that counts. And also, well, the reason why I wanted to have you on here is first of all, we're going to be discussing a psychologist that's well known to the world and an infamous and controversial psychologist, namely Timothy Leary. And also, I know you to be a close observer of the culture and of popular culture and of a lot of stuff that sort of intersects with psychology and sociology and culture and all of that. And I've invited you on because I see that you're going to be teaching an online course on Timothy Leary. And so I'm really interested to get your take on Dr. Tim and what his contribution has been, the pluses, the minuses, and so on. Let me start out by asking you, what's led you to want to offer that course?
Well, I've been involved with Leary's theories, I guess you could call them, or the Leary-esque paradigm, since the mid-1970s when he released something called his Future History series. The main two best-known books from there being Neuropolitics and Exotology. It seemed like he was moving into new ground. He was sort of a proto-transhumanist or a proto-post-humanist, really working with the idea of technologies leading towards an actual evolution in the human species.
Is that what you mean when you say transhumanist? Give us a...
Well, transhuman comes from the idea of the transitional phase between human and post-human. And all these terms are wavy because even the post-human is probably basically still a human being. It's a concept of basically expansion of the performance in some ways, what a human being is capable of, as well as how she feels and that sort of thing. Transhuman. And like I say, Leary, I think, was one of the first real sort of proto-transhumanists and started dishing out his ideas at a very interesting time in his life. It appears to me that his project came into focus at the very time that his reputation was at the bottom of the barrel. And I don't know how many people know the biography of Timothy Leary, but part of my motivation in doing this course was the fact that there was a biography written about Leary that came out about maybe 6 to 8 months ago by Robert Greenfield that was very negative and also very well written and poignant at the same time, but which showed no understanding of Leary's project. And as a result of the publication of that book, there were reviews in sort of all the major sort of liberal intelligentsia outlets, Harper's Magazine and the New Yorker and the New York Times, and all of them basically used the book as an excuse for attacks against Leary's character, which all in all may have some justification, but also for attacks against his intelligence and his value as a philosopher and a thinker. And in that case, the author of the book and the authors of the articles that commented on the book were entirely clueless, simply had no idea that he worked with ideas that people today are working with, at the edge of technology.
Yes. Well, let me back you up, because I suspect that many of our listeners, most of our listeners, may be younger than you and me. I don't know how old you are. I know how old I am.
I'm as young as I feel. I'm 54, actually, though.
Okay, so...
I'm a boomer.
Okay, you're a boomer, and I'm a post-boomer. And that's as far as I'll go, or pre-boomer. I'm not sure. No, post. Right. I would be a post-boomer. So I think a lot of our listeners probably, only know of Timothy Leary in some vague way. So maybe you could...
They may even think of a baseball player named Tim Leary.
Oh, really? I didn't even...
Yeah, there was a pro baseball player named Tim Leary.
Okay. Would it be possible for you to kind of step us through the high points and the low points of his biography, kind of to hit the main touchstones?
Well, I mean...
Just briefly.
There's no point in going through his whole biography, but in terms of his claim to fame in the early 1960s. He started experimenting with psilocybin at Harvard under the aegis of Harvard University. And
well, let me cut in at that point and give just a little bit more background to say not only was he at Harvard, but he was a, you know, to be a psychologist at Harvard, you've got to be intellectually very sharp. And he was at the top of the game in psychology, and he had published extensively, and he wrote a book on personality assessment that I don't know if it's still a standard in the field or not, but it was...
It's one of the standards. He wrote a book on transactional analysis and so forth. He was a pretty progressive person in the field of psychotherapy. He believed in the patient, the so-called patient, really the therapist or the psychologist acting as a coach more than as an authority, and more of an equal and dynamical relationship. And he did develop tests. Actually, he developed a test that he wound up taking when he entered the prison system. It was called the Leary's, which was a test basically that measured how well a prisoner could be trusted, whether he would be docile or troublesome or so forth. So he knew how to ace the test and portray himself as a docile prisoner. Which allowed him to get sentenced to a minimum security prison, and from which he climbed over the wall on a high wire. But I guess we're getting way ahead of the story here.
We're getting ahead. So he's back at Harvard, and he's experimenting with psilocybin, you said.
Right. He's experimenting with psilocybin. He's got a program that he's running with students participating, with religious people participating in it. They're having various experiments to show that psilocybin can, for instance, change the behavior of prisoners, that it can provide students of the working towards priesthood with religious experiences and this and that. So he's looking at it in terms of, a psychiatric drug in some sense. You know, that's where it starts.
Right.
At the same time, he's having powerful experiences of, you know, other dimensions and what seemed to him at the time to be spiritual experiences, and he recapitulates evolution in his psychedelic experiences, trips down all the stages of evolution. So he's starting to develop other theories that will emerge later on.
Well, we should mention that psilocybin is, what, a synthetic derivative or duplication?
Yeah, at the time, it's the magic mushroom.
Yes.
At the time, they were getting it in synthetic pill form from Sandoz Laboratories, where Albert Hofmann, the inventor of LSD, worked.
And now at some point then, LSD enters the picture, right?
Yeah, not too long. You know, once he's into the psilocybin, he becomes pretty interested in all psychedelic drugs, and a little bit of marijuana starts to get passed around. His friend Richard Albert, who later becomes Baba Ram Dass, is already a bit of a pothead. So before all this, so it's not too big a leap for them to wind up there. So a British fellow named Michael Hollingshead shows up maybe around 63, 64. With a bunch of LSD. And Tim is quite intimidated by it because it is active in, microscopic, sub-microscopic doses. But Hollingshead seems like such a chipper and such a puckish and pranksterish, charming gentleman that he decides that he'll take the risk and he'll try some LSD, and he called it the most shattering, profound experience of his life, and where he really tunneled into spaces that are perhaps beyond what he would call the game board of ordinary human relations. he developed a suspicion, a lingering suspicion that, in Eric Fromm's words, the games that people play really are something to be at least partially transcended.
Okay, and so sticking to the narrative part of it here, he began to share these with some people might think indiscriminately with graduate students and other people, and this gets him into big trouble, and he gets kicked out of Harvard as a result.
Yes, right. And so, I mean, they're conducting experiments, and they're being pretty scientific about it. And at the same time, as you probably know, and many of your listeners probably know, there is sort of a Dionysian aspect to psychedelia and the psychedelic experience, and one tends to loosen up and become very celebratory, and it's pretty natural that some people who dive deep into the psychedelic experience are not going to follow bureaucratic rules and regulations too closely. And, you know, frankly, Timothy Leary was just that sort of person. So, yes, there were parties, that were out of the bounds of the experiments, you know, beyond the subclinical kind of experiments. There were parties going on, and as far as I know, nobody suffered from them. But man named Andrew Weil, who many people probably know of right now, is a very famous a natural health person.
Sure.
Was working at the Harvard Crimson at the time, the student newspaper, and he exposed the partying that was going on.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and apparently Richard Alpert, a.k.a. Ram Dass, or as his father used to call him, Ram Dass, was using it to seduce some of his students. So that was part of the big crisis there at Harvard. So anyway, they both got more or less booted out of Harvard. It was a slow process, and technically Tim wasn't booted out of Harvard. He just was put in a position where he decided not to return.
Okay, now, you know, in a way, and we can come back to this, but I think sadly, because they did have some serious experiments underway, and there was reason to believe that these substances might be useful in treating various psychological, psychiatric conditions, and in treating people with alcoholism and treating people in prison. And there were some very promising research directions, and as a result of the negative publicity that got pulled down all around him, all of that got closed down pretty much to this very day.
Yeah, I mean, there has been something of a resurgence starting in the 90s. You probably know the organization MAPS out of Florida in the United States has been hard at work helping to put together research experiments, some of which have been able to take place under the aegis of the FDA in the United States, and many more of which have been able to take place in Europe. And there have been different reports, one that was pretty widely broadcast and spread in the newspapers and particularly on the net about some very positive results from psilocybin experiments out of Great Britain. And I think this stuff came out right around the time Leary's biography was circulating, actually, right about maybe about 6 months ago. And there's been various bits of news. There's been an experiment with ketamine at just the barely active dose as a potential day-to-day antidepressant. But the legitimate research, thanks to what some people say think of as Leary's irresponsibility, and also basically thanks to the fact that a rising hedonist counterculture that started really with the Beats in the 1950s had associated themselves also with psychedelic drugs, And this was already happening before Leary's experiments at Harvard. Ginsberg was one of the first, Allen Ginsberg, the poet and one of the leaders of the Beat movement, was one of the first people to come to Leary to check out some of his drugs. And he had his own drugs, and Jack Kerouac had been, sent off peyote, which had been legal. So I mean, there was an entire narrative already of a hedonistic, alienated outsider counterculture involved with psychedelics before Leary got into trouble with Harvard. So I think it's a slight exaggeration that is made by many of the people who are trying to have a continuation of legitimate psychedelic research that Leary is sort of to blame for the whole mess.
Okay. Yeah. So just to kind of quickly recap the arc of his biography. I mean, at some point he goes to jail. He escapes from jail. He escapes the country. He becomes a stand-up comedian. Take us through some of that quickly.
Well, yeah. I mean, after he gets kicked out of Harvard, he becomes an outsider and starts to set up his own. Sets up his own psychedelic sort of commune in Millbrook, New York, and a whole sort of hippie freak counterculture rises up, and Ken Kesey is off with the Merry Pranksters, dosing everybody on LSD, and the Grateful Dead are doing their thing, and the Beatles start taking LSD and start talking about it. So there's this very, and it all gets associated with the movement against the war in Vietnam, and with even more radical tendencies, left radical tendencies in the culture and so forth that passed in the 60s. And so Leary is subject to very intense scrutiny and harassment by various police forces, and winds up getting busted. The main thing he winds up getting busted for is just like two roaches of marijuana, but he's sentenced to something like 10 years in prison for those two roaches. It's generally understood that he's being sentenced for who he is and what he's said, and not so much for the marijuana. And the judge in the case actually makes it very clear that he's being punished for being what the judge called an indiscriminate Madison Avenue salesman for LSD. So anyway, yeah, he's there are various, I mean, it's such a long narrative, but he's in jail, he's out of jail, he's back in jail again for apparently a very long time, and decides to escape, and has his wife Rosemary help to make arrangements. And so he does escape from a minimum security prison in California by climbing, going out on a high wire hand over hand and getting over the fence. Little does he know that the arrangements that had been made was that a group of acid dealers called the Brotherhood of Eternal Love had paid the Weather Underground some pretty large amount of money, I don't remember what it was, to help with the escape. And I guess people who don't know the history of Weather Underground can look that one up. But they were certainly considered the top terrorists in America by the United States government, the FBI, and even the National Security Agency at that time. So Tim found himself in the hands of the Weather Underground, and they helped him to get out of the country, where he was pressured and convinced to go join with a Black Panther Party group in exile headed by Eldridge Cleaver in Algeria. So he wound up in Algeria, and this was in 1970 when people talked about the revolution, quote-unquote, the way we now talk about the Colbert Report or something like that.
Yeah, I knew lots of people who were talking about the revolution and when the revolution comes.
So he and Eldridge Cleaver were deeply caught up in this fantasy at the time, as was Kathleen, and as was Rosemary Leary, who really encouraged him to do this and get together with the Panthers. And then he had many problems with Eldridge Cleaver and the Black Panthers, and they put him under revolutionary arrest in Algeria and locked him up under armed guard in an apartment in Algeria. And he was he managed to escape Algeria and was at loose ends and ended up living with being kept by a how should I put this, kind of a gun runner outlaw petty criminal, you know, bon vivant, whatever you call
bon vivant.
named Huachard, who basically took care of him and helped to get him temporary residence in various cantons in Switzerland, while at the same time grabbing whatever money he could from Tim for various book contracts and so forth. So he was basically subjected to multiple kidnappings, and then can't remember the specific details of it, but decided to travel to Afghanistan, where supposedly the prince was a sympathizer, and he was kidnapped against international law by the Central Intelligence Agency in Afghanistan and flown back to California. By this time, on top of his the sentence for marijuana, he was facing a sentence for escaping prison, and he had also been blamed for mass manufacturing of LSD and distribution because he was sort of the philosophical guru to the group, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, that was involved in mass distribution of drugs. And even though Leary himself wasn't really involved in their business, the FBI tried to set him up as sort of the mastermind of this huge sort of hippie mafioso thing. So his bail was the highest in human history up to that point. It was $5 million. And that he was delivered into the hands of the government and went through a whole process there with very intense harassment and interest from the FBI and other forces, and eventually he agreed to testify for the FBI, or not necessarily for the FBI, but in court in Chicago about the Weather Underground, and to tell quite a bit, if not necessarily everything, about how he escaped from prison. And as a result of that, and as a result also of a change in California that put Jerry Brown in the governorship, and a person who had mutual friends with Timothy Leary, he was eventually released from prison.
Okay, and then didn't he become a stand-up comedian for a brief period of time?
He did something that he called stand-up philosophy. He toured with G. Gordon Liddy, debating G. Gordon Liddy. He did a whole bunch of stuff. He had, after he got out of prison, well, he towards the end of his time in prison and right after prison, he did his most important written work, which was his Future History series and his autobiography, Flashbacks. And he became involved in the evolving technoculture, and, you know, very much around people who were working on all the software and all that kind of stuff. It was very integrated into all that. And at the same time, he had a sort of weird Hollywood life as a B-list celebrity, appearing in movies and hanging out in nightclubs and all that kind of stuff, which is what the biographer Robert Greenfield focused on.
Okay. So, you know, at one level, he seems like the archetypal Irish rogue with the silver tongue. And he has the most extraordinary life. I mean, everything that you've just run through, it's got to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's only a fragment of the story, really.
Wow. It's got to be one of the most incredible lives. It's no wonder that he has some biographers, because this is certainly a life that's
out
for that.
There are three films in pre-production, one of them being organized by Leonardo DiCaprio, and a second one being organized by the filmmaker who made the film Pi, and I can never remember his damn name, but he's one of my favorite filmmakers. And then there's a made-for-TV movie. So, I mean, clearly it's a very cinematic. There's a long period of being underground in Europe that's incredibly cinematic. Tim sort of saw himself as a psychedelic intelligence agent after a while, because, I mean, that's kind of the world that he lived in through the 1970s. It was cloak and dagger.
Yeah, you know, I feel like he had an impact on me and on my life. I've tried to figure out for myself, well, how would my life have been different if there hadn't been a Timothy Leary? And I suspect that it would have been different, and that many people, it would have been different for many people of my generation. I'm planning to title this show The Legacy of Timothy Leary, as I'm kind of struggling to figure out what that legacy is. I assume that's kind of what, some of what you'll be examining in your course. But, you know, I'm wondering, you know, and maybe you could speak to this, you know, what would be different if there had been no Timothy Leary? Would there have been a civil rights movement? Would there have been an anti-war movement? Would there have been an environmental movement? Would there be the mass interest in Eastern thought and spirituality, yoga, meditation, etc.? Would there be a war on drugs?
These are well, I guess we'd have to take that one at a time. There would definitely have been a civil rights movement. You know, that came through Martin Luther King and through you know, left liberal activists and through a lot of African Americans and so forth. There would have been an anti-war movement, and there's great debate within people who are part of the anti-war movement in the 60s as to what the effect of the psychedelic counterculture was on the anti-war movement. People from the hardline left tend to claim that the use of psychedelics depoliticized people and you know, took them away from activism and revolutionary thinking and all that. The evidence is just the opposite, actually. In 1967, 1968, 1969, the anti-war movement grew and flourished into a mass youth movement that was built around a cultural identity that included drugs and sexuality and, you know, kind of libertarian leftism that the hardline leftists don't like to recognize. So I think the answer there is probably that the anti-war movement would not have been quite so powerful without Leary's influence and the influence of psychedelic culture. It also probably wouldn't have been so crazy, which could have been both a good and a bad thing. Certainly, some people will tell you that experience in psychedelics, you know, brings you into a place of instant peace and love for humanity. But on the other hand, the CIA people were taking LSD, and the Weather Underground was taking LSD, and then, you know, blowing up army buildings and stuff like that. Yeah, of course, there are very extreme riots going on, of course, as you probably know, and then 1969, 1970, 1971, people burning down the Bank of America and stuff like that. And all the people who were doing that kind of stuff were the freaks. They weren't the straight leftists. They were the psychedelic freaks. And you were in Ann Arbor. They had the White Panthers.
Yes.
And, you know, there's two things to say about the fact that psychedelics might have made the anti-war movement act a little crazy. And one is that it damaged the movement in terms of how most Americans who were turning against the war would relate to it. The second thing you can say about it is that it might have stopped Richard Nixon from nuking Hanoi. And there's historical record of Richard Nixon getting very serious about nuking North Vietnam during this time period, and just being scared out of his wits about what the anti-war movement would do to America if he did that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he wasn't thinking about the Quakers when he was frightened.
Right. Now, what about the environmental movement? Do you feel that that was at all?
Well, yeah, I think the environmental movement and that sort of sensitivity to the environment certainly was amplified by psychedelic culture. I mean, there are all these movements exist probably without Timothy, and maybe even a psychedelic movement exists without Timothy. A psychedelic counterculture movement exists without Timothy. Maybe it does, you know, you can't really remove a single person from history and sort of play the whole thing back and see what happens without him or her. But all these things were definitely amplified by his presence.
Yeah, it's hard not to wonder. Go ahead. I lost my thought. I was going to say something. I forgot what it was.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure where we're at with this either. But I mean, Ken Kesey, of course, was turned on by as a result of CIA experiments at Stanford University in Palo Alto, and very much without needing to have any influence from Timothy Leary, he grabbed a bunch of psychedelics from that place and started passing them around to his friends, and the culture grew in Palo Alto and San Francisco around psychedelic drugs.
So let's move now more towards the course that you're going to be teaching and some of the topics that you'll be exploring there. You know, why is it that we're still talking about Timothy Leary and that you'd be teaching a course now these many years later?
Yeah, well, this is where I want to get with the courses. I mean, one thing there is that there has been a public fascination, however limited, because we live in a very decentralized culture, and, you know, people don't pay attention very much, of the same sort of stuff, but there's been at least some attention to his biography, and then I want to take a look at how his biography and his experiences leak into his project, and how his project is relevant to us today. And, I mean, basically, Leary worked on ideas and fostered ideas that are at the edge of a technological movement today. Everything from the empowerment through the internet, you know, the decentralization and distribution of the power to convey and distribute information, giving that power to individuals and to small groups.
Yeah, the whole idea that information should be free, right?
Yeah, delivered a talk in 1979 to a Libertarian Party convention about the internet, where, you know, everybody thought he was nuts and didn't know what he was talking about. You know, obviously, if he was speaking to a Libertarian group, he was talking about the liberating possibilities of the internet and how it gives power from the individual and takes power away from centralized media, and that's pretty much exactly what has happened there. But he has also dealt with, central to his ideas in the 70s and beyond that, is that the age that we're moving into is defined by neurologic, that it's a neurological age, that we will be able to control and activate and do things with our brain. We'll understand the brain. And that definitely seems to be one of the places that we're headed. If you look at my book, True Mutations, there's a whole section called This Is Your Brain on Technology, and there's an interview in there with Zach Lynch, who I can't remember exactly the name of the site that he runs, but he shows how we're moving through the biotech age into the neurotech age, and how intelligence enhancement and performance, neurological performance and neurological reward, and all those things will become primary metaphors probably in another decade or two. And I mean, he also dealt with human beings having power over our own biological evolution in the mid-70s, and these are this is something that's just beginning to come to fruition, and there are numerous ideas that he dealt with way back then that are dead on in terms of what's going on now with bioengineering and germline engineering, where you know, basically we can manipulate human beings at the level of the seed to create perhaps superhumans and that sort of thing. And I mean, he dealt with molecular technology, nanotechnology, before anybody really thought about it. You know, he implied molecular technology in the 1970s, and he implied a singularity. And some people will know that there's a popular narrative now in technological culture about the idea that we're going to go through a singularity sometime in the middle of this century.
Yeah, can you say what that is? Say a little bit more about
that. Well, I mean, there are so many different versions of it, but the most popular version is the technological singularity that's advocated by Ray Kurzweil, and it's the idea that the amount of, basically the amount of information that we can deal with is doubling at a continuously quicker rate of speed, and that by some point, maybe in the 2020s or 2030s or 2040s, we're going to be able to make machines that are smarter than we are. And the machines, one thing about machines that machines can do that we can't do is, as soon as one machine knows all the information it can possibly know and has all the problem-solving intelligence it can possibly have, every other machine has that same intelligence. And it's like, you know, you or I sitting here can't be as smart about quantum physics or about, you know, filing tax returns or, you know, programming a computer or, you know, bottled water or whatever you want to think mm-hmm. of as people who specialize in that area. But if we were to be able to unite with silicon implants that are capable of downloading all the information that's available to one machine, you know, onto all machines, we would all have all the same capacities. And when, once the machines get intelligent enough, they start to resolve problems that allow them to get more intelligent still. And Kurzweil just sees the machines as moving just unimaginable light years beyond human beings in terms of intelligence and capacity. In a very time, other people really like the idea that human beings and machines will be integrated into one form. But I mean, that's just one example of the singularity. The basic idea comes from physics, and you know, it's basically an event beyond which you can't comprehend what is going on there from the current point of view.
So
and Leary talked about it in terms of his eighth circuit of the brain, a whole other theory of the evolution of the human brain, of neurology, neurological evolution, quantum level of neurological evolution.
This is probably too simplistic, but I want to say Timothy Leary, devil or angel, you know, where do you put him?
Well, Tim was against guilt and against authority, and probably would have sided with Faust and with Lucifer, I think, in the various narratives there. I mean, it all depends on your perspective. You know, he wasn't Henry Kissinger. He wasn't Idi Amin. He wasn't. He wasn't in the army. He wasn't. He wasn't out killing people. But he certainly was no angel. I don't think he. Some of his fans, I think, want to bestow sainthood upon him, and he always hated that.
Yeah. Do you think people will still be talking about him, say, 100 years from now?
It all depends on how the future goes. And in his future history series, he did have an ego, and he imagined that humanity would look back and say, there was this guy in the 1970s who got it. You know, I think, you know, this is about a 1 in 20 chance that he might be right.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, he might be forgotten.
Yeah. I wonder if there's anything else that you'd like to say that we haven't gotten around to here.
Well, I guess just let people know that I have this book, True Mutations, Interviews on the Edge of Science, Technology, and Consciousness. It's dedicated to Timothy Leary, and it's because it deals with all the topics that he got me interested in, including the brain, including the potentials of biotechnology and nanotechnology and quantum physics and evolutionary theory. And, you know, I did forget to mention that really central to Tim's work in the 1970s were ideas that would eventually become evolutionary psychology, and he nailed so many of those things. He was very DNA centric, which was very much ahead of his time in those terms.
You're right.
I hope people will check out the book, actually, because in some ways it's an update of his work.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. I've got a copy here. True Mutations, Interviews on the Edge of Science, Technology, and Consciousness. So really, it's very relevant to people who listen to this show, listen because they're interested in psychology in one way or another, or they're interested in consciousness. We have lots of people who are interested in Buddhism that follow the show, for example.
Yeah, I think people will find, listen to your show, will find the section 2, This Is Your Brain on Technology, very interesting, with Stephen Johnson, who goes and, goes on under fMRI and learns about how his brain functions. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. And there's certainly discussions of psychiatric drugs and what some of the problems are with them and how they might improve in the future, and definitely a lot of stuff that's happening now and in the near future in terms of cognitive sciences and to some extent in terms of psychology.
That's why I like to listen to your podcasts, because you have guests who are talking about these very interesting cutting edge things. Particularly your Neophiles podcast is right in this very domain that we've been talking about. I forgot to ask you: did you ever meet Timothy Leary?
Oh yeah, sure. He worked for Mondo 2000. He was one of our editors, and he was always very generous. He did everything for free, I used to go and stay with him in Beverly Hills, and he used to come and stay with us in Berkeley, California. I spent a fair amount of time with Tim, and I co-authored his last book, which was called Design for Dying. Actually finished it after he died, made it easy because I can make all the decisions myself. I did know him pretty well.
So
Tim had, you know, 10,000 best friends, and I put myself on the top of the list.
Yeah. So what was your personal, what's your personal take on him?
Well, I miss him more than anybody, because Tim at his best could make you feel like the entire world was a fabulous party, mm-hmm. and that he was the gracious host, and the energy that you could get from hanging out with him for a day or a week could last you for months. I mean, it was almost mystical. You know, it was almost like one of those gurus who puts his finger on your third eye and suddenly you're illuminated, except he hated all that bull. Mm-hmm. And it was just his joie de vivre, you know.
Yeah.
But it was so powerful. And, you know, he could be a real cretin sometimes, too.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's a perspective, you know, that people don't get exposed to so much. The first part of it, not the cretin part, but the first part that you said. And also, there's one annoyingly square question that I meant to ask you, which is about your name change from Ken Goffman to Are You Serious? How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, as some people probably know, there was a writer who was actually a collaborator with Timothy Leary named Robert Anton Wilson, put out a bunch of wonderful books, just recently deceased a few weeks ago. And I was just at a wake for him on Sunday, as a matter of fact, and he wrote about people who get messages from Sirius, from the dog star Sirius, in his book Cosmic Trigger, semi-seriously, he wrote about it, and I made it even less serious by adopting the name Are You Sirius, R.SIRIUS.
Okay, great. Well, it's a wonderful name because it kind of poses a metaphysical question in a way.
It does do that.
Yeah,
it's an open invitation to alien contact from the dog star as well.
Okay, well, we are eagerly awaiting that contact. And I want to thank you very much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Are You Serious as much as I did. I find him to be a fascinating person, and he is really well networked to a wide variety of other very fascinating people and visionaries. As I mentioned, I'm really enjoying his two podcasts. One is called The Are You Serious Show, and the other, The Neophiles. And if you're at all interested in the cutting edge of research on consciousness and sort of the outer limits of what's possible of science fiction and science fiction turning into science reality, this is a very interesting guy and set of podcasts to follow. I had some reluctance about inviting him on the show and doing this particular topic of thinking about Timothy Leary because people have such strong reactions to drugs in general and to psychedelic drugs in terms of their attitudes. And I was worried that I might lose some listeners as a result of this. So let me say right up front that I'm not proselytizing for drugs or for psychedelics at all. And I had a recent insight that there's a kind of cultural divide, I think, between people such as myself who were around in the 60s and who got involved in this movement that was going on at that time, and people who either weren't or who've come along since, so that any discussion of drugs today or psychedelics immediately brings up images of heroin addiction, crack cocaine, meth, urban blight and decay, lost souls, and so on. Just a whole bunch of negative imagery, which of course is fully justified by lots that's going on in the world. At the same time, some of us who came up in the 60s really have a very different frame of reference and a different set of associations having to do with the exploration of consciousness, and the exploration of spirituality. I actually had a chance to hear Timothy Leary speak early in after he left Harvard, and he was going around the country speaking at various colleges, and he came to the University of Michigan, where I was a graduate student, with his message, which was, turn on, tune in, drop out, if I have the order right. I did turn on, and I did tune in, and I certainly thought about dropping out, but I didn't drop out. I did really wrestle with that. But I think that Leary had a big impact on people of my generation. So remember, I was a graduate student in psychology, and I was very interested, as I still am, in exploring psychological dimensions, possibilities, consciousness, and so on. So based on what I was hearing in the media and at that time, it seemed that here was a very powerful tool for exploring the realms of consciousness. Aldous Huxley had written about it. Other leading intellectuals had experienced it, described their psychedelic experiences. And I felt almost that I owed it to myself as a professional to explore this set of tools that were being made available. And so it was that with that kind of attitude and spirit that I went into it. And it wasn't with an attitude of, there was a social dimension to it. I suppose there was a certain recreational aspect to it, but there was also a very serious aspect for me and for other graduate students who I had contact with and who were also interested in exploring these things. One of the things that Leary and other people around him wrote about was the importance of set and setting, and I think that continues to be a major insight. The experience that a person is likely to have with these substances depends very much on their set. That is, what's the attitude that they go into the experience with? What are they looking for? What are they intending? And then the setting. And it makes a big difference whether the setting feels safe. And it makes a big difference whether or not you know at some corner in your mind that you're doing something that's illegal and that could land you in prison. So it makes it a lot harder to visit spaces of bliss and joy when you have that very real fear lurking in the background. Again, I'm not proselytizing for drug use and or even drug exploration by anybody listening to the show. It's been over 30 years since I have had any psychedelic experience. And I suppose I should add, part of the reason for that is not only did I have some very blissful experiences, but I also had some very terrifying ones that I'm not eager to revisit. I think part of the tragedy of Leary's story is that it led to the criminalization of substances and thereby foreclosed important research, because I wish that it had been possible to continue research on the use of psychedelic or other mind-altering substances for the treatment of a variety of psychological and social disorders, drug addiction, alcoholism, and so on. Because early indications seem to suggest that there were some really powerful possibilities there for positive benefits. And now it's very hard to even explore or have a discussion about the possibility of positive benefits because people are so polarized and such negative imagery has been generated around all of this. I think I would like it to be possible for research to be carried out on how pharmaceuticals might produce improved mood, improved functioning, improved happiness, motivation, etc. People don't blanch at the idea of smart drugs. They assume that drugs are going to come along that will make us smarter or that will improve our memory and things like that. But the idea that there might be drugs that could make us happy, that could produce us a feeling of bliss or, quotes, feeling high, somehow that's very forbidden right now, very dangerous idea. And so we continue to rely on things like alcohol, which is socially accepted, but causes great social harm, as well as physical harm, physical addiction, physiological addiction, It's bad for the brain. It's bad for the organs of the body. And it certainly is conceivable to me that science could develop some substance that would be safe and useful. Other societies have learned to handle psychedelics within a religious, spiritual, ceremonial kind of context. And again, that goes to set and setting. There are substances that should be made available, perhaps, but bounded by certain social rituals and contexts and places and times and so on that contain them so that they don't run out of control and become harmful. I want to give a real plug to Are You Serious's book, which is a collection of interviews, and they're very stimulating, challenging interviews from the ones that I've read so far. The name of the book, again, is True Mutations, Interviews on the Edge of Science, Technology, and Consciousness. It's available on Amazon.com. It's only $14.95. I have no financial interest in this, by the way. It's a really good deal. You know, if you want to read some very challenging, thought-provoking interviews, this is a great book to refer to for that. Let me read you a couple of paragraphs from one of the articles that came up in our conversation. The title of the interview is Feeling Groovy Forever, and the interview is with someone called David Pierce. He says, here's one paragraph where he says, one of the most common objections to the idea of abolishing suffering is that without the spur of discontent, we'd soon become idle and even bored. If we were all happy, what would we do all day? But enhanced dopamine function is associated not just with euphoria, but with heightened motivation, a deeper sense of meaningfulness, significance, and purpose, and an increased sensitivity to a greater range of rewards. So one possible option for paradise engineering is to focus on enriching the dopaminergic system to promote a genetic predisposition to lifestyles of high achievement and intellectual productivity. There was another paragraph that made an impression on me, so skipping ahead several pages, I think this is the paragraph I'm looking for. I hope it is. In short, we need a vastly enriched conception of mental health. At present, if a drug company came up with the ideal pleasure drug, a real blockbuster wonder drug designed to enrich the lives of everyone who took it, then it simply wouldn't get a product license. Absurdly, there's no way it could legally be marketed. This is because to get a product license for an investigational drug, you have to indicate some officially recognized disease or disorder that the drug alleviates or cures. Just helping the dull-witted and malaise-ridden, as we all are by the lights of posterity, doesn't count. Crazy, he says. And I thought that was a telling point, that companies can explore drugs that are designed to bring people up to a certain level of what we call normal, but not to take them beyond that. So I'll bet I get some emails on this topic. I wouldn't be surprised. And finally, I want to give a plug to Are You Serious's online course. If anybody's interested, there's just time to do it. I've actually promoted this show ahead in the batting order. I had a different show that I announced was going to be next. But if I did that other show first, then you wouldn't get this in time to possibly take Are You Serious's online course. So if you're interested, go check it out at http://. I didn't need to say all of that. It's www.maybelogic.org/courses.htm. That's maybelogic, MAYBELOGIC. And it looks like they offer a variety of online courses, not for credit. There is a fee, but I don't think it's for university credit. I think it's just for the sheer joy of learning. It's an 8-week course, and it runs from February 26th through April 27th. So check it out.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Somehow that jingle seems particularly appropriate on the heels of my preceding rap. A big thank you to our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. Remember, you can use the discount code of SHRINK3 at checkout to get a discount on your next domain name at GoDaddy.com. And you can find other discounts on the GoDaddy link on our website. We have a link to our listener survey on our website as well, and at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. And if you include your name and email address, you'll get a little surprise in return. We've got two new additions to our Frapper map, and I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Gord Jones in Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and John O'Connor in New Egypt, New Jersey. Welcome, guys. There's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can add yourself to our Frapper map, and I hope you'll do so. I've put three short videos up on YouTube recently about the Zodiac serial killer case. I did it as a way of advertising Shrink Wrap Radio, and I'm wondering if they've brought in any new listeners. So if you discovered the show as a result of my YouTube videos, please drop me an email and let me know. I've also just put up a very interesting interview I did with Dr. Jeffrey Young, founder of Schema Therapy, an approach which integrates psychodynamic, behavioral, and gestalt therapies. You'll find that interview at http://wisecounsel.mentalhelp.net. And there's no www.
Have I been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio, or is it really all in my mind?
Without further ado, let's go straight to our mailbag. Once again, I've run a bit long, so I'll just read a couple of short emails from several weeks ago that I never got a chance to share. The first comes from Tim, who is a personal counselor in student support services at the University of Queensland in Australia. And he writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Thank you very much for having Scott Miller as a guest on your show. I really enjoyed the interview, and your considered questions helped me to understand where other therapists are coming from when I discuss this new information with them. This was the first show I listened to. However, I will be listening in as much as possible from now on, and I've added myself to the map in Brisbane, Australia." Thanks again, Tim. Tim, thanks so much for that email and for your support. And I have to agree, I think the Scott Miller interview was one of the best. And next we hear from a listener in Mexico City who writes, "My name is Fernando Blanco from Mexico City. I'm not too fluent at writing in English, but I'll give it a try. I've just listened to your show on your own reflections of Tarot, and though I'm not a believer, your model of analyzing this kind of material is truly helpful and has taught me lots. In a way, it's a shame you'll have to devote yourself to the other show, but I guess it had to happen. I hope you can keep giving us some great podcasts as the others have been. I'm 37 and studied psychology, but I devoted myself to financial stuff, and your podcast has given me a great and comfortable way to remind me of my passion for this area of knowledge. Unfortunately, my colleagues find it hard to keep up with English. I want to thank you for sharing so much. I feel I've managed to make the most of your show and your comments, so I hope there's lots of shows to hear. Thanks again, Fernando." And Fernando has been doing some work with me since writing that letter in terms of editing a couple of shows, and I really have appreciated getting to know him and getting his help. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And you are encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo, just like the transition we had today, which was recorded there. You'll find a link to that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. All you need is a microphone hooked into your computer. If you don't have a microphone, you can leave a message on our phone line in the U.S. by calling 206-888 2746. So thanks to listener and keyboardist Nir Ben Zion in New York City and his saxophonist friend Duty Comedy for our theme music. Thanks again to Are You Serious for the interview. As I erroneously announced at the end of the last episode, our next show will be about understanding and improving memory with psychologist and author Dr. Thomas Crook. I really mean it this time, and it should be a good one. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying it's all in your mind.